Jack Vance, The Languages of Pau, an introduction to the 2008 reprint of the novel by Subterranean Press. Jack Vance loved to invent elaborate, gorgeous pageantries of costumes and manners, castes and classes, and to recount histories of powerful men scheming and striving for more power, set in countries with remarkable geographies and exotic names, on distant worlds in a far future. On returning to those Vancean worlds after many years, the first thing I noticed, with surprise and affection, was how familiar they are. Despite the science fictional apparatus of spaceflight and super high technology, they aren't alien worlds or future worlds. They are our own lost world. They are Earth before the airplane, Earth in all the centuries when it was boundless, endlessly rich in mystery and strangeness, when there were blanks on the map, when Samarkand, or Timbuktu, or California were names of legend, when Marco Polo was a stranger in Cathay, when Baghdad was where the thief lived. About the time we started to destroy that world, industriously shrinking it to the size of a theme park or a shopping mall, we started writing about worlds out in space and their alien beings and ways. When the National Geographic ran short of exoticism, science fiction took over. Jack Vance seems to have enjoyed that compensatory invention immensely for its own sake, and he did it with the true Thousand and One Nights flair, the deadpan realism of the best traveler's tales. The Languages of Pau was my favorite of the many Vance novels I bought in the 60s because I liked its subject. Vance was always aware that language is an interesting and tricky business. Unlike many science fiction writers who still routinely present a whole planet or even galaxy of people all speaking the same tongue, it is easier to explain airily that everybody speaks English ever since Earth installed the Galactic Empire than it is to cope realistically with Babel. But the trouble with a monolinguistic universe is that it's shrunken, artificial. We're back in the theme park, the shopping mall. Vance didn't share the imperial reductionist mindset, common to his generation of SF writers, that dismisses variety as unimportant. Rather, he revels in it. His various peoples speak variously, and their names reflect the different phonologies of their languages. Vance's writing style is certainly that of one to whom words, both the meaning and the sound, are important. He has, and it was a rare thing in science fiction in 1958, a real and personal literary style. His dialogue is often dignified and formal to the point of being stilted. People say things like, "This credence which you deprecate may be no more than fact." This is a mannerism, but if you accept it, a rather endearing one. The rhythm of his narrative is calm, sedate, musical. His descriptive passages are direct and exact. He gives you a sense of what the weather is, what the colors of things are. He places you in a setting. Above reared the rock slope, far up to the gray sky, where the wild little white sun swerved like a tin disc on the wind. Baron retraced his steps. This little passage is typical, the first sentence for its vivid description, poetic, exact, restrained. The second for its slightly old-fashioned phrasing and its simplicity. Vance did not waste words. He is as far as possible from the grab-em-by-the-balls school of action writing, yet he was an action writer. His plots move forward, not rapidly but steadily, with an impetus that carries the reader right along. He was in full charge of his story. The characters, the plot, the scenes, descriptions, actions, all are under control, and control is, perhaps, one of his great subjects. The Languages of Pau concerns a struggle for the control of a people, a political conflict, a moral debate. As in others of his books, it involves a vast population, but is acted out by a very few characters. One is a boy, Baron, inheritor of a world empire but reduced to dependence on a man of enormous power, Palafox. The plot is in fact the classic duel of father and son, complicated wonderfully by the fact that the father has literally hundreds of other sons. Pitting the father's pitiless megalomania against the boy's struggling sense of justice, Vance sets up his conflict cannily. Palafox, for all his power, is utterly controlled by the perverse society that formed him, and even the language which gives him his power. While Baron, because he is not committed to any one alternative, has a hope of freedom. The element of speculative science informing the plot is known as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which says, stated crudely, that our mental outlook is formed by our language. What one can think depends, to a large extent, on the words one has to think with. Because linguistics is a soft, or social science, diehards of hard SF must dismiss this book as fantasy, but such quibbles grow ever quainter. Meeting the reasonable requirement of using a durable, if much questioned, scientific hypothesis as a major element of the plot, Powell is excellent, solid science fiction. Vance understands Sapir-Whorf, and, while applying it with due caution, elaborates it convincingly and spins a lively yarn out of it. I feel a certain old-fashioned quality to Powell. Perhaps it was always there, inherent in Vance's dignified language, his unhurried pacing, and his avoidance of ubiquitous, gratuitous violence. But it may also have something to do, now, with Vance's inescapable masculinism, an almost universal failing of the genre at that time. Women are perceived, if at all, as contingent on men, appurtenances. A shadowy girl, Zitan, plays a brief passive role. Some nameless victims of Palafox's lust are glimpsed. Baron has a father but no mother. He neither seeks nor finds a wife. Male interests are the only concern. Men perform all actions except domestic service. Men fill every leading position. Even madness is gendered, for Palafox's psychotic plan to populate the world with his sons is merely a hideous exaggeration of the male sex drive, the selfish gene embodied. What women want, feel, think, or are plays no part whatever in the book. This is, of course, true of many novels, even now, even those with nominally female characters. Vance's lack of interest in half the population of the world was, at least, undisguised by hypocritical pieties. Respecting his writing as I do, I tried to see the story as a critique of male dominance, and it can be read so, but the reading is unconvincing in the complete absence of active women characters. So this fine novel may seem, to a modern eye, maimed. It is benign and thoughtful, yet its omission of half of humankind from agency cripples an otherwise just, subtle, and generous moral stance. Jack Vance made no pretense to literary greatness, I think, but he held himself to a far higher literary standard than most pulp fiction and genre writers of his time, and he was true to his own vision. For that he deserves lasting honor. May a new generation of readers discover the joys of traveling far beyond the shopping mall and the theme park, to the eight continents of Pau and the bleak heights of Breakness.